Tradition, the Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, published by the Rabbinical Council of America, is proud to present A Jewish Philosophy of Man, a lecture series by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. The Rav delivered this series of 12 lectures in 1958 and 1959 before an audience of Jewish social service professionals as part of a program of the Jewish Education Committee of New York. Using audio files provided by the Toras HaRav Foundation, these recordings have been curated and remastered by Mark Smilowitz in order to provide the best listening and learning experience. For more information, including full transcriptions and supplementary materials for this series, please visit the Tradition website at traditiononline.org/JPM. Lecture 4, Judaism's View of Man as a Lonely Being, originally delivered on December 18th, 1958.
Particularly, the question of the individual versus the community are as it was formulated by classical philosophy. Basically, when classical philosophy spoke about the individual, it was not a relationship to the community, but to mankind. Classical philosophy didn't know the community. It's mankind, the universal, man, universal man. All these concepts, community and state, were simply, not known. The classical philosophy, as the concepts are known to us. Basically, in Greek, they didn't even have the concept of state. It was more the government at the time. And I tried to derive from the theory of the individual certain practical conclusions. And I tried to interpret the Greek philosophy of man in moral and also in social terms, as to social welfare and so forth. Of course, we have to take up the problem of the Jewish of the individual within Judaic thought. But before I'm going to take up this problem today, but before I do it, I would like again to see how this classical influence has asserted itself in modern philosophy with regard to the individual versus the community. When I say modern philosophy, I don't mean modern philosophy in the sense of contemporary philosophy, but more modern philosophy since the age of enlightenment or the age of reason, since the French Revolution, about that time. Or perhaps tracing it back to the English positivism, Hume, Locke, and so forth. In order to place the classical view of man in focus and to appreciate the enormous influence, and I'm doing it for the sake of contrasting the modern approach with that of the Jewish approach. Because when you say individual, the very concept of individual is very vague, and you can interpret individual in two different ways. And to appreciate the enormous influence it exerted, the classical view of man upon the emergence of modern theory, and in order also to assess properly the significance of man in Judaism, it would be advisable for us to investigate the controversy in modern philosophy relative to the problem of individual versus the community. Basically, there are two doctrines as regards this relationship, between individual and community. And in the course of this lecture, I'll show that Judaism disagrees, and I may add the adverb, violently, with both theories. But let us first see, these two opposite viewpoints, and also realize that Judaism cannot accept either of them. Basically, there are two doctrines as regards the relationship between the individual and the community: the individualistic doctrine and the positivistic, or also the idealist. The first theory, which is found its most succinct expression in the philosophy of the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, says the individual being is an independent entity, provided with natural prerogatives and innate rights. He enjoys full aboriginal freedom and is endowed with creative aptitudes for which he is not indebted to anyone, since he is the originator of everything. Of course, reading, for instance, the Declaration of Independence, you'll find the echo of this individualistic theory in the Declaration of Independence. At the beginning, if I may use a biblical phrase for that, at the beginning, there was the individual, not society. Later came the community, the collective, which is to be understood in terms of isolated individuals who joined up and formed a society. The latter consists of single selves who retain their autonomy even after they have left their solitary abode and united within a community. The individual is capable of managing his affairs without appealing for aid to the collective. He is self-sufficient. The I does not need the Tao or the He. Of course, the meeting of all three, it means of the Ha, of the I, the Tao and the He, and their coalescence into society makes life simpler and more comfortable. Yet an individual isolated existence is quite thinkable and also possible. It is for a very good reason that the doctrine of individualism, who was called by theologians a Robinson Crusoe philosophy, and Dilthey, the famous German social philosopher, and Buhner, the Swiss theologian, have already pointed out that this theory, granting primacy to the individual and isolating him from the social texture into which he was woven, coincides with the attempt of classical physics and chemistry to atomize matter and to interpret holes or processes in nature in terms of particles and isolated entities. It coincides with the conceiving of big events as resultants of infinitesimal sub-occurrences. This is exactly what physics does. So taking the community, atomize the community, and interpret community in terms of the individual. Interpretation of the macrocosmos is the sum total of microprocesses. Yes, and why do I throw this theory? It's well known to you. I'm advancing nothing new, because people I read lately, that people identify this theory with the Judaic viewpoint. This is exactly what the people say. This is not the Judaic viewpoint. Whether the individual came first is a different problem, but the individual is self-sufficient and, so to say, and completely an isolated existence, and the community is something which appeared later, either by the naive concept of contract social, which is a very naive concept, or because of certain other forces which made individuals coalesce into a community. This is not the Jewish viewpoint. We'll see later what the Jewish viewpoint is. Of course, the opposite view of the individualistic theory is the theory of idealism, which is directly influenced by the classical theory of man, which places man within some ideal supra-individual system. The individual is placed into a supra-individual system. The individual existence can only be understood is looked upon as a manifestation of an all-embracing higher entity, be it the class, be it mankind, and be it also, as Hegel wants to say, the objective spirit. The individual, the single person, vanishes behind the universe, the whole, the general. Whatever the individual is, whatever he possesses, his abilities, aptitudes, creative talents, his experiences of a free existence, is rooted in the supra-individual unity or entity, which avails itself of the single person as an instrument of manifesting something higher and greater. I don't want to go into detail as to the different schools which deny the autonomy of the individual and seeing him only a medium through which something more worthy expresses itself. There are many schools. Important is only their general contention that the individual is only a part of the whole. Whether this view is formulated in universalistic Hegelian terms or in the accents of the romantic theory of organic growth, like Herder and so forth, or in the positivistic, materialistic verbiage of Marxism, and its class doctrine is irrelevant. What is significant is the conclusion that the individual serves the collective, while the individualistic doctrine of man maintains that the reverse is true. I mean, it's very usual to say here that the state serves the individual. Of course, it's very simple to say within a totalitarian system that the reverse is true, that the individual serves the state. I mean, Judaism could not identify itself with either of these doctrines. We'll see later why it is so. So when I said, when I developed last time the classical theory of man is only a representative of mankind, so of course, you might have thought that the reverse would be, so to say, subscribed to by Judaism, to the individualistic theory. That's exactly what I want, very out, so to say. The Judaism does not subscribe to the individualistic theory, as it has been formulated by the philosophers of the Age of Reason and so forth. Judaism has a very peculiar approach to that. I just introduced these two theories. There are many more, between, but in order to show the contrast, what I want to say now, to try to develop, is the Judaic interpretation of man, in particular, his relationship to the community. Question, is the individual autonomous? Is the community supra-individualistic entity to which he must feel committed? Or on the contrary, there is no commitment on the part of the individual to the community. In contradistinction to these two basic views, basic anthropological philosophical views, Judaism has introduced a new idea of man. Let us move slowly. Answering the question which intrigued the finest minds, namely, what is man? Or rather, as I said last time, what is the distinctive element in man? We'll find that Judaism has two distinctive elements in man. Perhaps three. But we'll discuss now just one, the first one. This is the most important. So he said in Greek philosophy, the answer was the intellect. I showed you in Maimonides in the guide, in the first chapter, when he speaks about Selam, Maimonides also adopts this viewpoint that man is distinct by his intellect, because by his rational ability and capacity to understand himself and to understand his environment, and finally to somehow to subject the environment to his own plans or ideas. Yes. This is Judaism, basic, genuine Judaism, unadulterated, I would say, by any philosophical jargon or any extraneous influences, but pristine. And between you and me, basically pristine Judaism, where are the sources if you want to get that? Well, I would say medieval philosophy of religion, of course, medieval philosophy of religion, Jewish religion, it was written by great scholars, Maimonides, Halevi, Saadia, Bachya, Yersinides, and so forth. But unfortunately, they were children of their time. And their time was moving in the orbit of the Greek philosophy. Greek, a bit, I mean, colored by Neoplatonic mysticism. It's a combination of Aristotelianism and Neoplatonic mysticism. Even my mind as a rationalist is also a mystic. Because this was, so to say, the climate of the time. The rationalistic on the one hand, and mystic on the other. And Maimonides, you never know where Maimonides is the Jewish scholar, whereas the Greek, the disciple of Aristotle and Plotinus. After all, sometimes sometimes you deal with Maimonides, the Jewish scholar, in a second, he vanishes and is replaced by an Aristotelian. It's hard to know sometimes. That's why the sources are not too reliable. Basically, there's only one source which is very reliable, and this is the Halacha. The Halacha is an unadulterated source. It was very far removed from the outside world. Extraneous influences did not reach the Halacha as much as they reached the philosophical minds, the Halachic scholars. It was a group for itself. And in the Halacha, the basic Jewish viewpoint came to expression. The trouble is with the Halacha, as I told you, the Halacha speaks in terms of laws, in terms of legal concepts, Halachic categories.
When you have to find a philosophical background, you get involved into a job of reconstructing out of objective data a great religious experience. It's very difficult, I told you, the passage from the objective data. Technical rules of behavior. The passage from technical rules of behavior to a great religious experience, to the passionate religious personality, to the homo religiosus, is a very torturous one.
But we'll try our best to try to develop out of halakhic sources, the theory of man. Because after all, the halakha deals with man, and if it formulated laws for man, and legislated norms for him, so it must have had a fear of man. Otherwise, you cannot legislate. In order to legislate for somebody, you have to know this X. If it's unknown, you can't solve the equation. If there is no equation, the equation is this, or the equation, there is an equation, and the equation is insoluble. So you cannot say anything. Now, I'm not quoting any laws. I have many laws, to corroborate what I say, and many stories. I have nice stories, but it's not a question of telling you stories, you see. I have to bore you a while. I'm the bore, but I can't help it. It should be placed in a philosophical perspective. Judaism has introduced a new idea of man. And I'm convinced about it. I'm very, as far as claims which people make on behalf of Judaism, with regard to its participation in the emergence of culture, I'm very modest. You should not lay claims to things which we have not contributed anything. But however, with regard to matters that we have actually proclaimed to the world, ideas which we have actually advised the world about their existence, so you should take pride in it. And this is one of the ideas that Judaism gave to the world. Answering the question which intrigued the finest minds, namely, what is man, the Bible said. And you look at me in surprise, I'll tell you. Man is a lonely being. And in this feeling of loneliness, the distinctness of man manifests itself. The first distinctive element in man, which sets man apart from nature, or from creation in general, is this solitude. Call it loneliness, call it aloofness, but his solitude, his separateness. Why is he lonely? Because, that's what Judaism will answer. And I'll show you the no answer. Each man is not only a single individual. This is not well formulated. But also a singular being, not a single being,
but a singular being. And right here is one of the reasons why Judaism could not accept the individualistic theory of God. Although Judaism believes in the individual, because the individualistic theory of man did not speak of singular beings, but of thinking beings, like atoms within physical matter. So it means each being equals the others, like two atoms. Each atom, I mean, within a particular element, I mean, they equal each other. Like two electrons, the subatomic structure, or two neutrons, they equal each other. All right, okay, in the emergence of society, they said, the atom came first, concrete matter later. Concrete matter, well, society is a coalescence, basically, of atoms, of individual atoms. But the individual is only an atom. They are all identical, the same aptitudes, the same creative talents, the same experiences. It is the same existential experience that's important. The same antic awareness. It is just atoms many. Of course, they were very gracious to say that individual is responsible for the society, not society for the individual. But the individual itself is just one of many, or one among many. And there are many like him. There's almost an infinite number like it, like there's an infinite number of atoms. It's just atomization of society. But atomization of society does not mean restoration of the dignity of the individual. Because in order to be a dignified being, it's not enough if I say I am responsible for society. But now we don't care for you. Because if you are not here, someone else will fill the void. Someone else will replace you, will supplant. Because the same abilities. That's exactly what the question is. Is it just a single individual? That's what the individualistic theorists said. That's what Rousseau and all of them said. It's a single individual. And basically, when you read carefully the Declaration of Independence and then Jefferson, there is no singularity of the individual. He speaks about the dignity of the individual created in the image of man. And of course, and they ascribe the so-called the lex natura, the natural rights which are inherent in the individual. Yes, but individual to them is replaceable, is dispensable. If not Mr. X, then Mr. Y. And if not Mr. Y, Mr. Z. Judaism's greatness in this regard was, it said the individual is not only a single being, it is a singular being. Let us continue. God created man. Now I'll show you how Judaism arrived at that. It was not just a caprice on the part of Judaism. God created man in his image. B'Tselem Elokim Bara is. And the divine aspect of man expresses itself not so much in his intellect. I mean, the intellect of man is a bit naive. But rather spiritual and mental capabilities or aptitudes which the human being possesses in contradistinction to the animal and the plant, but in his very existential experience of aloneness. It's better to say, later we'll see what's the difference between loneliness and aloneness. It's better to say that the image of God expresses itself in the fact that man is lonely or solitary, in his aloneness and otherness, in his estrangement and separateness from creation in general and from the Tao in particular. Man is lonely with regard to two, should say at two levels. He is lonely with regard to the forest, if I should find myself in the forest, or some in the woods, or in the fields. I'm lonely among the trees. I'm lonely among the animals. I'm lonely in the jungle. Right? This means the loneliness, which is estrangement of man from creation in general. There is also another concept of loneliness of man and experience at the social level. Man is lonely not only with regard to the forest, these animals, of the ocean, and to this, to the heavens, is only also lonely with regard to the Tao. I find myself at Times Square, and I'm a stranger, I also experience loneliness. But not loneliness, I mean, which makes me so feel my estrangement from nature, but makes me conscious of my, so to say, of the gap or the gulf dividing me from the crowd. Why is it so? So let's not forget that Judaism is a monotheistic religion. We all know it. Our basic article of faith found expression in the opening verse to Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. The word in Hebrew for one is Echad. You know, but basically Hebrew Echad means not only one. Echad in Hebrew, everyone knows, has the feeling from the semantic aspect of Echad, and the Hebrew words, means not only one, but it means the only one. Not only one, but the only one. So basically, there would be two translations of Shema Yisrael, Shema Elokim, Shema Echad. We would translate it not here or Israel, God is our, the Lord is our God. The Lord is one.
I would say, the Lord is our God, the Lord is the only one. And of course, you can make a mathematical equation. Only one Israel, the lonely one.
So actually, if you want to translate Shema Yisrael in English, it would be here in Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is Lord. Strange, what is it? Because Echad means not only the Lord is one,
but is unique, is the only one, is singular, has no friend, has no associate.
Basically, Ibn Ezra, the medieval commentator of the Bible, says so. He says the verse in the sense, God being alone, not one but alone. Even the German Jewish scholar, one of the fathers of liberal Judaism, Zunz, Leopold Zunz, also translated this verse not only as one, but also as unique. God is unique. It means lonely. What does it mean, God is lonely? God is different from all other beings. He is only other than all creatures. His existence is singular and incommensurable with our existential experience. So this means, what does it mean, lonely, only one? His existence is different from ours. In the Maimonidean philosophy, the Echad, as implying, if I may use a term, a theological term introduced by Otto, the German term, the noumen. Noumen means the unknowability, the strangeness, the otherness, something which is different, something which is incommensurable, incongruous with whatever I know and I experience. The noumen, the unique, incomprehensible, incommunicable, and inexpressible existence. To Maimonides, this incommunicability of God's existence to others, his uniqueness, his unknowability, his loneliness, his aloneness, sounds the keynote of all philosophical thinking in Judaism. All, according to Maimonides, all we may predicate of God, according to Maimonides, is his incomparability with creation and his unknowability. This is the only attribute what you can say. What you can say about God is, he's not like us. Can't see anything positive. And you know the famous doctrine of Maimonides, many call it the docta ignorantia, or negative theology, whether these terms are true is a different problem, but it means we all can know about God that he is different from us. Now, if you just, you have, the, is there the guide here? You have the guide? If you just be so kind and open the guide, first section, and chapter 60, first section, attributes of God, page 88, page 88, page 88, page 88. I don't want you to believe me if my mother says so. I mean, you'll just check it. No. Page 88. Fourth line, page 88. For it has been shown that every perfection we could imagine, even if existing in God, in accordance with the opinion of those who assert the existence of attributes, would in reality not be of the same kind as that imagined by us, but would only be called by the same name according to our explanation. It would in fact amount to negation. When you say God exists and you want to subsume existence of our category of existence, it's a wrong statement. You can only say God exists not the way we exist. Nothing else. Or rather, if we should employ Maimonidean phrase, he does not exist the way we exist. Negate. Yes. Now, suppose we can skip that. You thus necessarily arrive at some negation without obtaining a true conception of an essential attribute. On the contrary, you are led to assume that there is a plurality in God and to believe that he is only one essence, has several unknown attributes. For if you intend to affirm them, you cannot compare them with those attributes known by us, and they are consequently not of the same kind. You are, as it were, brought by the belief in the reality of attributes to say that God is one subject of which several things are predicated, though the subject is not like ordinary subjects, and the predicates are not like ordinary predicates, and so forth. So my mind is the whole chapter 60 and 61 wants to show one thing. All you can say about that, that he is not like us. So what does it mean in other words? If one is not like us, so what is it? In simple English, he's alone. Because if he's like us, he's not alone. If there's commensurability, there's something common denominator. There is something universal in both of us. He's not alone. There is nothing in common between God and creation. Now, Judaism, as a matter of fact, also spoke of God as the lonely being, abiding in seclusion, hidden in his infinite recesses, and a solitary being. And this is when you want to say a solitary being, or the only one, and you can say instead of Yahor, you say Yahid. Yahid means already not one, although Yahor itself involved this only one, but Yahid means the only one. And we have a passage in the Bible, in the Pentateuch. We have the English translation. Yes. With this, would you be so kind and take it is Deuteronomy 32:12. Deuteronomy 32:12. Adishem Badat Yan Shalom. Veinimo Hilecho. The translation is a very poor one. It says, God, so the Lord alone did lead him, and there was no strange God with him. But Badat is more, Badat is alone, not in the sense no one helped him, but he is alone. It's not in the sense no one helped him. Because if we would, if we had expressed this, it would say, Ad Hashem Levato, But here is God. God, the lonely God. Get it in translation. God, the lonely God. Badad. Badad is lonely. God, it's a Yashva Badad. God, the lonely God. The lonely God lead him, and there was no strange God with him. The God, the Lord, the lonely Lord, the lonely one. God is always enveloped in a cloud, cloud of darkness. Clouds of and darkness are about it. This identification, God with the cloud, is very familiar to everybody who knows the Bible. God is descended, enveloped in a cloud. Let us take, for instance, the Psalms 97, if I'm not mistaken. 97, the Psalms. Clouds and darkness are round about him. I mean, there is, I believe, a passage like that, a verse like that. 97. You say the Rotary, one of our authors, loneliness of God, 97, you heard?
Is that 97?
Oh no, second verse. Clouds and darkness are around about it, correct?
Yes. What does it mean, loneliness?
Always the cloud as a symbol of isolation, aloofness, solitude, seclusion, withdrawal. Loneliness of God is perhaps the highest term of Judaic theological thinking. Why is it the highest term? Because it has a tremendous influence over our social philosophy. If God weren't lonely, we couldn't have developed this beautiful social philosophy. We did. Since man was created in the image of God, his specific endowment consists in his existential loneliness. And I'll explain later what it means, which is an expression of his uniqueness and separateness from being as a whole. And modern psychology and psychiatry, many, have erred in their interpretation of the feeling of loneliness. It's a basic mistake. Of course, this mistake has penetrated lately theological thinking, and all pastoral psychologists, means a rabbi who is not a psychologist, or a theologian who is not a psychologist, or the other way around, a psychologist who is neither a rabbi nor a theologian. So this combination is a very funny one. When they speak about integrating men into society, simply trying man to help him, he should rid himself of his feeling of loneliness, solitude. I mean, he is making a basic mistake. Of course, it is not always, loneliness is not always this integrative and devastating emotion. I say not always, sometimes yes. Later will come when loneliness becomes disintegrating or a disjunctive emotion, or a devastating emotion. Not always is it a negative emotion indicating disturbance or frustrating experiences. Only at certain times, loneliness is engendered by mental desolation and forlornness and is indicative of a sick soul, yes, at certain times. Yet, loneliness is not only to be found in the area of morbid self-introspection, of unfounded fears, inferiority, self-loathing, and debasing, or self-contempt, but also, and perhaps mainly, in a new dimension, in that of human greatness, and human dignity, and glory. Man is great and glorious because he is lonely. When the psalmist exclaims, "For thou hast made him," 8, if you don't mind, Psalm 8. Yes, here it. "For thou hast made him." A little lower than the angels, yes, you? Do you have it? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, yes? It says, what verse is it? Huh? Yes, for thou hast made him a little lower than the angels. Again, angels said my translation. But chasreyu mi'at melekim, does that mean angels? Sometimes in the Bible, elekim is a substitute for angel, for malach. But basically, all elekim means than God. You just made him a bit lower than God. And has crowned him with glory and honor. Yes. So what does it mean, a bit lower than God? Not with regard to our capabilities. As far as our capabilities are concerned, we are not just a bit lower than God. We're very far removed from God. When he speaks about a bit lower than God, he refers to the existential experience of man, and he refers to the unique gift which was bestowed upon man, namely his loneliness, his solitude. Of course, the feeling of solitude is a painful one, no doubt about it. Through it, man comes, full loneliness perhaps, man comes close to the reality of suffering. There's no doubt about it. I don't say it's a very comfortable feeling. It's a painful feeling. However, this necessity of coming close to the reality of suffering is also an opportunity to share in the travail of an inspired existence. And who knows whether one can share in the great drama of existence without subjecting oneself to pain or to suffering. Now, let us see. God is lonely. Man is lonely. Conclusion is one, is very simple. What is the conclusion? That man draws toward God and God searches forward toward man. Two lonely beings meet each other. Basically, the meeting, the rendezvous between man and God, because both are lonely. And how beautiful, I mean, Plotinus, not the Jewish philosopher. Beautiful. You find it in the Psalms. What is actually religious experience if not the flight of the lonely to the lonely one? There's only one difference. The first L in lonely is small, and the lonely one are capital. But this is true from a Judaic viewpoint. The first approach of man to God and God's moving from his transcendence toward man manifests the paradoxical mutual fascination. The lonely finite being and the lonely infinite being are subjected to. Man searches toward God because he is lonely, abandoned by creation, as such, forlorn in his seclusion and aloof and aloneness, and in order to allay his painful experience and to help or to heal his tormented mind and tortured heart, and to restore them to the health of serenity and of an existence in fellowship, and God, who is lonely, meet because one experience combines them both. This is the strange existential experience of solitude, which man is eager paradoxically to escape, in which we find the threads of an existence dedicated to some ultimate ends woven in the fabric of one's personality. It's both. He wants to escape it, and his day is great because of this experience. Now, particular attention should be devoted to the nature of prayer. What is prayer?
If Judaism didn't know the concept of loneliness, Judaism could not develop the idea of prayer. No, it's not. Prayer attached to the Judaica.
The Greeks didn't understand. To them, prayer was more singing an aesthetic hymn. Also, I mean, you see something nice, you write a note. Was the ode, I mean, ode in Horace. Nothing but the ode. But the ode is not a prayer. Because basically, you know very well that the so-called hymn plays a minor role in Jewish prayers. The so-called extolling hymn, or even the thanksgiving hymn, plays a minor role. What is the main, the very core of prayer? It is so-called intercessor prayer, or the petition. What many call it, because of ignorance, the selfish prayer. When I ask God to gratify my need. But in Judaism, we call it because the intercessor prayer is indicative of man's crisis, of man's distress. The hymn is not indicative of distress, of crisis, because prayer in Judaism is combined, knitted very closely with sarah, sorrow. Sorrow means distress, when one finds himself in straits, in narrow straits. Yes, one said, I mean, when I come to Eretz Israel, I forget all my sorrows, but I found sarah. But this is what does sorrow mean? Sorrow means not calamity, I want you to understand. This is again a mistake in translation. Not calamity, not catastrophe. Sarah is sar. Sarah Libo means narrow. When a woman finds herself in narrow straits, mina mitzah, from the narrow straits, out of the narrow, or depth of fullness, and I find myself somewhere in the depth, I come. It means the man is in crisis, basically, it's crisis. It is distress, but not the surface distress. It is depth distress. Distress in being itself. And those in this exactly drives man to pray. Drives him to pray. That's what the hymn. We have the hymn. We have the psalms and many hymns. But basically, 75% of all the psalms is God answer. Answer my petition. I follow him. I mean, as a matter of fact, in the recommended reading, I wanted you to read, I mean, these psalms. In which the distress comes to expression. The book of Psalms ends the distress. I am lonely. I am poor. The people, I mean, I'm forlorn. I'm on the brink of nihility. I'm at the brink of hell. I mean, I can't find myself. Help me find myself. I'm trying to escape my fate, my destiny. I mean, this is the motif. This is exactly long. If not for long, this is why Judaism has emphasis, stress. But underline the intercessory prayer, or the so-called petition, and or the selfish prayer, as it is called by some theologians. You take the Shemoneh Esrei, Shemoneh Esrei composed of not 18, 19, so you have only six. Mm-hmm. Actually, you have only a few which deal with singing a hymn to God. But mostly, simply, I specify my need. And at the end, I say, I cannot specify my needs. You know my needs better than I do. So please answer. Particular attention should be devoted to the nature of prayer. One of the most exalted religious experiences. Prayer basically is a dialogue between God and single man. An encounter between a lonely soul and its lonely creator. It's only a dialogue between two people. It's you alone. It's not a symposium. So if the community comes to God, then it is a symposium. It's more than a dialogue. And prayer is only a dialogue. It's you alone. You do see it. Only between two. Who is the two? On one hand is a one. Yeah. But on the other hand, who comes before God? Not a community. We have communal prayer too. But basically, the Jewish prayer, not the communal prayer, and this is the individual prayer. And this is one of the basic mistakes. It is, for instance, not that I'm criticizing, but it's a fact that liberal Judaism has made by eliminating the individual prayer and the individual approach. Just communal singing, communal participation. Yes, no one is lonely. No one is lonely. I feel very comfortable. Particularly the type of temples that are building now, the million-dollar temples. I don't believe the lonely soul can. He's already comforted by the beautiful pictures and he's proud. See. prayer comes to expression in the basic desire of men. Basically, prayer, I want to depart for a while from the concept of individual versus community, and just in order to show that prayer is based on loneliness and religion. Basically, prayer expresses a certain needy man. Employ a biblical metaphor, this need, I would say, expresses itself in what Isaiah said, Ki mipicha kol derech tishova kol ashe. Surely unto me every knee shall bow, and every tongue shall swear allegiance. We have it in our Alkine Kavanah. Every knee should bow. Why should every knee bow? What does kneeling mean, basically? Kneeling is also one of the symbols in religious life, how one expresses his feelings, his emotions at the religious level. What does it mean? This means the I who wants to surrender to the greater Tao, the lonely I who wants to surrender completely to the lonely Tao, because lonely Tao is capital, to submit himself to someone, but the someone is again capital, to unburden himself of the heavy load that fate and fate doesn't mean bad fate, not bad fate. Fate means existence itself. As placed upon his sprained shoulders, he is eager to share many a time responsibilities implied in his creative role assigned to him by God, and to turn himself over to someone in whom he has trust. And in whom can he have trust, if not in the lonely being who understands him? If that we are not lonely, we couldn't come to him. He couldn't have any sympathy for us. This peculiar wish manifests a state of fatigue, but not fatigue, physical fatigue, not even mental fatigue, what we call ontic fatigue, fatigue of being, of metaphysical exhaustion, not psychological exhaustion, metaphysical exhaustion, of disgust with life and with everything it has to offer to man. This is prayer. Prayer is self-abandoning and complete surrender. And in this very act of surrendering, tired man finds solace and quietude. And Freud erred here, it's a basic error in Freud. He considers, when he speaks of the infantilism involved in the religious experience. On the one hand, he was right when he says that religion has the element of fatherhood, the child running to the father. This is right. I wouldn't say this is the entire religious experience. It's one of the aspects of the religious experience. But there is one of the basic aspects. We run to God as a little child who finds himself in distress or in trouble, runs to his father, he should help him. Yes, correct. The child who is incapable of solving his own problems runs to his father, who is supposed to accomplish what the youngster cannot do. Yes, he's right in there. I wouldn't argue with him. But he's wrong if he thinks that this is impenitent, that the need for casting off anguish and sorrow in the lap of God, the Father, is far from a neurotic attitude of infantility on the part of frightened man. It is instead a very healthy response, sometimes, to crushing defeat and crisis. The feeling of insecurity ends many a time when security is found in the lonely down. And it's interesting, if you want to take a look, Psalms 55, chapter 55, verse 23. Hashkoich ala deshem yirakba, v'yitalka laka. Cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. Cast thy burden, 55, verse 23. Cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. Will you be so kind and read in the following verse? I don't have it in my manuscript, the following verse. And in English, what's the following verse? Will you be so kind, 23? He will never suffer the righteous to be moved. Yes. The lonely person comes before God, man in despair and fear, kneels before him and hides his head bent under the heavy yoke of living. And he, at his bosom, men whom everybody has forsaken and betrayed find shelter in God. Prayer means a feeling of being forsaken by everybody. No one understands me, not because of the fault of me, and not because the other fellow is wrong, not of any culpability on the part of any fellow. No, I don't blame anybody, I don't indict anybody, because he can't understand me. Why? Because he's lonely and he's like, I'm lonely. How can two lonely beings understand each other? I'll come later to this explanation. That's why the individual is forsaken. It's not an indictment. Men whom everybody is forsaken and betrayed find shelter in God. Men who forfeited everything, friendship, sympathy, and understanding on the part of others. In a world, lonely man clings to him. And this means every knee bows before thee, because every knee must lose its arrogance and security at one time or another. Now, if you'll be so kind, you open the psalm again. Psalm 27, verses 9 and 10. And you read it, you'll see what prayer means. 27. Let David worry. As a matter of fact, it's recited the whole month of Elul until after Shmini Atzer. Verse 9 and 10. Hide not thy face from me. Put not thy servant away in anger. Thou hast been my help. Cast me not off. Neither forsake me, O God of my salvation. For though my father and my mother have forsaken me, the Lord will take me up. Father and mother have forsaken. And we'll see later in history. Not just the phrase, the history. I mean, it appears strange how father and mother can forsake a child. We'll see about it. This exactly. And that is why, and please, I'm not, please don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to preach any orthodoxy. But and now it's by and sheer force of associative thinking that I have to mention it. That's why we often choose our post to the family pew instead. The family pew. You know why the family pew is wrong? Why there? If I ask you why the family pew is wrong, according to our thinking, why do people want to have a family pew? Why does the American Jew want to? To pray together. This is wife and children. He wants to feel comfortable. So he takes a look at his wife. She is the big one like him. Fortress of strength. The children, they wouldn't desert him. They wouldn't forsake him. They, whenever in need, whenever he'll be in need, he can come to his wife. That's exactly what David, the psalmist, wants us not to believe. That's why we fight against the family pew, because we want to isolate the individual from the family, at least for an hour or two. And to come to God, or before God, as a lonely individual, has no family, no wife, no children, no parents. You know that basically we never allowed child and father to stay to sit next to each other. Because the child takes a look at his father, when he has trouble, he'll come to his finite father. So there is no. And the basic element in prayer, the conditio sine qua non, prayer is this sentence, this verse in the psalm, ki abi vi impiazum, father and mother, best friend, staunchest friend, a man, have forsaken you. And this should be not only its positive mental experience, But as a mental experience, we have to create an environment, a climate. It's a very soft seed. And I have my wife, children around me. If I say it, they seem to say, wow. This is exactly the basic philosophy why you oppose. I mean, a lot of nonsense has been said about us who are opposed to the so to say, to the fair sex. It's ridiculous. But if one knows what the status of the woman is in Halakha, cannot say it. Such statements come from people either who are ignorant, simply they don't know what the station of the woman was in Halakha, or they're not ignorant, or they simply distort back. Of course, it's a very daring indictment, but I have to say, it has nothing to do with the question of sex. It has to do with the problem of family. Not family in the synagogue. In the synagogue, not the family comes, not the community comes. There is no community in the synagogue. It's nothing. They're isolated individuals, but still, yet you need a place for worship. So there is physical contiguity, so to say, in space. But mentally, each one is a world of itself. And he looks upon the other one as a stranger, not as my neighbor, as my friend, as a stranger, as a one who is completely indifferent to my suffering, to my problems, to the doubts which assail my mind, who is completely absolute, has no concern for me. And there is only one friend I come to. This is the Lord will take me. Now, let's go. The humanitas of man culminates in his loneliness. The latter is not, as a rule, a devastating, but an ennobling experience, the absence of which shuts out the vision of God from one's life. And that's exactly what is wrong with the basic philosophy of peace of mind as an alien religion. At least Judaism. I have no right to speak about religion and Judaism. Of course, I see now sociologists begin to attack this problem and philosophy. But basically, it's wrong that peace of mind means complete forgetting about one's death crisis. It means a belief that I am fully successful. Successful at the highest level. And I saw many fools who think they are successful. That men cannot be defeated, that he didn't suffer any defeat. And of course, they measure success and defeat in terms, in their shower caps, in making money on this social station,
this cannot be. There is no need for that. At least the need is a second tower.
The flight, as Plotina said, and the lonely to the lonely one can come out of distress. We Jews believe that there are two kinds of distress, two kinds of crisis. One crisis we call the surface crisis. Surface crisis. For instance, disease, famine, war, poverty, it's a surface crisis because it does not touch the very existence of man, I mean, his experience as an existent, as a person, it's because it's due to certain environmental conditions. And these conditions can be alleviated and changed. Today I'm hungry, tomorrow I can have money and buy bread. Today I'm sick, tomorrow I'll recover. And so forth. This is surface crisis. Surface crisis, of course, also. I mean, a man who finds himself in this type of crisis, I mean, wants to God. But Judaism said there is permanent sorrow. There is a permanent sorrow. There is a permanent man finds himself in permanent distress. Permanent distress. And this is not just due to his environment, due to certain conditions. It is because his very being is in distress. And no one can help it. While, for instance, surface crisis can be understood by others. If I am sick, people express sympathy. When someone is hungry, people will extend help to him. But there's a certain crisis, distress within them, not on the outside. to which men say subjected, but within man, which no one understands. It is the impossibility of attaining complete success. It is the necessity for defeat for that. It is the necessity to share the reality of me. I don't mean physically. It is, and this distress, this permanent distress, state of distress, prevails as long as man is man. Because man's humanitas, man's, so to say, singularity expresses itself. And one of the basic aspects of this permanent distress is the aloneness of me. And here comes prayer. If you want to alleviate, come to God.
Of course, it can never be alleviated completely.
I'll show you how it expresses itself in Allah. And that's it. Whoever does not feel himself and feel that he is in distress, in this permanent distress, experiencing distress, experiencing incompleteness, experiencing, so to say, a crisis, he can never meet God. The vision of God is shut out of his world. Only the lonely person, always in distress. Take for instance, Judaism has formulated the aspects of this inner distress and permanent distress, where they are. But it's not the time, just on his son says, I have to check. Will you be so kind? Will you be so kind and look up Psalm 130, the famous Psalm, De Profundis. You're depressed. Could you give me, the English text? Yes, would you be so kind? 130, yes. Out of the depth have I called thee, O Lord, De Profundis. What does it mean, out of the depth? What kind of depth does it speak? What kind of depth? How do we find ourselves? In my distress, I called unto the Lord, and he answered me. O Lord, deliver my soul from lying lips, from a deceitful tongue. What shall be given unto thee, and what shall be done more unto thee? Thou deceitful tongue, sharp arrows of the mighty, his calls are grown. What does it mean, out of my distress? And what is distress? It doesn't specify anything here. Sickness, hunger, war. What is this? The lying tongue, the lying lips, and the deceitful tongue. Who is lying? Who is lying? Where did we see liars? Are there so many liars this morning? Everybody. Call out on Crimson. Why is he a liar? Because when he displaces by the tongue, for the Tao, he basically does not feel the Tao. The Tao is not real to him. Is the Tao real to him? When we come to express our condolences in the case of death, when they come to visit the sick, is the Tao real to me? As a rabbi, I visit the sick. Of course, I pay many visits of condolence. So is the distress of the other fellow real to me? And I say, I'm sorry, and I have sympathy. It's lying lips. It's a deceitful tongue. Because deceit is a part of man, because he's one. There's no understanding of the other and the part of the other. And this is the permanent distress in which man practices. And of course, the more mother man becomes, the smoother he talks, the richer his vocabulary is, and the easier he can roll off sentences, the bigger a liar he is. O Lord, deliver me, my soul, And there is no indictment upon us. Because I am the same liar as he is. Because I'm lonely, he is lonely. And there is nothing about it. 120, 110. Now, this is the basic element which is overlooked in modern way. The basic element was, yes, sir.
Why is the million required if prayer is a question of the individual being alone?
Do you know what the million is required, I mean, ironically, for the saying of the Kaddish and for the recital of the Kedusha? This means for the youth. But not for the intercessory prayer. The singing of the, what is Kaddish? Kaddish means the singing of the hymn. The hymn. Glorified and exalted be his name. Or Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Sanctum, Sanctum, Sanctum. It's the hymn. For the hymn, but not for the intercessory prayer. The hymn, of course, thanksgiving, these glorious tones. Hymnal music is much nicer than the rhythm. But when man comes to surrender, to hide his head in the lap of God. Say, everybody betrayed me, even father and mother have forsaken me. You are my only friend I have because you are alone and I am. You understand each other. There's no meaning required.
The tradition of son not following father as an aliyah. That follows
what you said before that. No, it's a different reason. The reason is because whoever is called up for the aliyah testifies that the Torah is good. And the law is that two relatives are disqualified from testifying. Okay. So if you call out the father and the son, so they cannot testify. Because according to Jewish law, two witnesses must testify in order to confirm something. His testimony of one witness is not enough. So then you call out the first one and the second one, so both testify. Torah temet, it's a true Torah. But father and son can never testify together. This is it. Because Kriya Satora is not prayer, I want you to tell you. It's a part, it's not prayer. It's a thief at a different level. Kriya Satora is basic style. I mean, there is a combination of prayer and style, it's a different prayer.
There's evidence about father and son not praying together.
In Ramah, in Isalis, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the cult, he said that one should not embrace the child. Or even pet his child, or even look at his child, caress his child with a glance during prayer, because it should be because everybody is forsaken, etc. It's a simple, clear, current law in the code. I don't remember now the paragraph, but next time I'll be I'll write you a letter. I'll
let me just read.
Yes,
prayer. Prayer book, very stock. Everyone will say the word.
Correct. The question of standardized prayer.
I'm just wondering, there's David Brings, where there are the silence of prayer.
Yeah, I know, the silent prayer, I'm on the point. I mean, you know, basically, I want you to understand. I mean, we are getting away from our topic. Basically, prayer is what we call in the Latin terminology, Avodah Shebelev. It is the service by the heart. This, so to say, physical act of pronouncing words is more a medium, a technique, than the very act of prayer. Why standardized prayer was introduced is my mind is explains, because simple people don't know how to express themselves. And in order to make prayer democratic, there was an element of democracy, as my mind is explains. For the man, the literate person, could have said beautiful prayers. This was before Ezra, before the Great Assembly. The person who is a stutterer, I mean a stutterer, but a man in the language, the primitive person couldn't pray. So in order to it's a act of a democratization of prayer, basically. Because again, as I tell you, Judaism is also an institutionalized religion. As an institutionalized religion, it has to reckon with the needs of the masses. You cannot keep something at a lofty level and simply bar the masses from participating. That's why prayer has been standardized, but the experience of prayer has never been standardized. It shouldn't be standardized.
Well, if that is so, certainly the prayers that are recited are foreign in terms of our tongue today.
What do you mean tongue? In terms of language?
Yes.
You mean language simply because it's Hebrew and English?
That's right, kind of translation.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I mean, basically, prayer can be recited in every language, you know. That can be the text and observed. This is law. Yeah? Prayer can be the basic law is that prayer can be recited in every language in which a person speaks. However, I mean, I would recommend that people should study prayers in Hebrew because there it's very hard to translate something. I showed you Echod. Echod has not been translated. Or Bodat is longly, I mean, it's hard to translate. There is no genuine translation for anything. But
what should we accept the translation of the Lord? Our God, the Lord is one. Instead of saying the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Which should you accept the more likely apt translation?
I would agree, I've never thought about it, but I would agree more that the Elokeinu is a qualifying, is a clause. It means the Lord our God. As a qualifying, as a clause in commas. I would put it in commas. As a clause. I would put it as a clause. Yes, sir.
The concept of the Sarah, which is for a moment, it can sound, at first blush, anti-psychological in the sense that it is an unchanging, immutable Besara that responds not to changes of social condition, ethics.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that it's immutable or unchangeable, alterable. Of course, for instance, the way I experience it is dependent upon the general cultural constellation and my position within society, of course. But always say that everybody must experience incompleteness in itself. Incompleteness and also failureness. Defeat at a certain level. Body levels change, and the terms of this, the experiential terms in which I may interpret this, certainly are subject to cultural changes. But I say you can never, so to say, redeem yourself from this. It is permanent, you cannot redeem this. But let me speak about loveless. If I may just... Now, let us see what is loveless, basically. What is loveless? We spoke and spoke and spoke about it, but still we didn't define it. Of course, you know very well that only man is lonely. The lion, the horse, or the cat is not lonely. You know that's well. It's hard to say, but let's assume so. Anyway, let's assume so. As much as the humane society is trying to tell us what is humane slaughter, what is inhumane. I've asked one of the leaders, did he interview an animal? How does he know? It is, of course, it is an inseparable part, as I said, of our existential awareness, not our mind. Let us see. And please, I would ask you to pay attention. I begin to bore now. I'm becoming a bore, but for a while, just for a short while. While the whole universe shares only surface existence with man, only surface existence, the human being lays claim to a depth existence as well. And I'll explain this. If we attribute, for instance, reality to a certain object, a particular object, such as a stone in the inanimate world, or the animal in the organic zoological kingdom, or to this mic, or to this glass, this book, we say the stone exists. What do you understand by saying the stone exists? Or this glass of water is? Water is real or is existing. So all we say, it exists at a behavioral level only, or insofar as this object is affected or and by and affecting change in others. It means this object can be affected by some action, or can also affect action in others. It means in terms of causality. The stone exists in its reality is equal. If you ask, what does the reality of the stone equal? A mathematical equation. What will you say? The sum total of mass and energy, that's all. You look at the book of physics and say, the sum total of mass and energy. Of course, is equal the behavioral sum total of its position within the causal nexus. It exists as much action we can ascribe to it. Understand me? Whatever the stone is betrayed and expressed by its activity. It exists outside, on the surface, because it may affect changes in other objects. It may also be affected by the impact of other objects. And of course, the fact that it is affected, these objects are affected, it affects changes in other objects, because you see, the causal nexus is a continuous one. Any change here invokes a change there. It exists outside on the surface, expressed in mathematical equations of mass and energy. There is no existence to be attributed to the stone other than one manifested in its causal relational behavior, in its activity. Of course, I cannot say activity of a stone, but in its effectiveness, whatever the stone is, its whole existence is exhausted by its relatedness to others. The stone alone doesn't exist, you understand? It exists as a cause and an effect within the whole of the cosmic drama. And this is true not only of the stone in the book, it's true of the stars and the suns of animate and inanimate nature. Therefore, to make scientific observations of things, of dead things, or even of animals, but particularly of dead things, is epistemologically a simple task. Of course, it might be associated with technical difficulties, particularly at the microcosmic level, but there is one thing which is true. The stone doesn't lie, does it? Or the animal doesn't lie if the stone is interviewed. I mean interview not in the sense of a dialogue, but I mean interviewed in the laboratory, under the microscope or wherever it is. It doesn't lie. Whatever the scientist observes is true. And this is why the natural scientists are so fortunate that they can predict with exactness the behavior of the stars and the moon and of the stone and of the drop of water for a simple reason, because those objects don't lie. And why don't they lie? What is lying? Lying means my behavior is something else, and my within existence is not commensurate with my within existence. There is no within existence in stone. Whatever it is expressed to others, you see. Nothing is hidden in the thing itself, beyond its behavioral surface. There are no indentations in the stone, indentations or abstruse corners. No secrets, nothing. There is sometimes secrets in matter, but finally we get out the secret. And how do we get out? We observe, the behavior of matter. How do we get out? Do we get out, the secret of the subatomic structure? By a beam of light. Because when an atom gets off the orbit, there is an optical effect. And this is true because the atom would not light up. However, many things. He certainly exists like other things, of course, and we can understand man by his behavior, certainly, within which he finds himself on par with other things, or with the concrete order within which he finds himself placed, namely on the outside. He also lives on the outside. We live through our talking. How do people know of us? Because of our speech, our actions, of our reactions, responses, of our endeavors, and so forth. And yes, of course, one may also equate human existence with his deportment, correct? And dismiss the other existential aspects completely. As a matter of fact, I'm not speaking successful through my head. As a matter of fact, many psychologists have done so and have ego ipso, and they've equated men with his behavior. All psychology of behaviorism, that's all. For the psychology of, what do you call it, of association? Spencer, Stuart Mill, all of them, in particular in American behaviorism. Of course. So what does behavior psychology behaviorism say? What is man? The sum total of his activities. So it means man is an outside existence. He has no within existence, or perhaps he has, but we are not interested in it. I mean, say the way it is, but that's all. But of course, by this statement, they destroy the very concept of the human personality in its unique station within the realm of things. We, the advocates of religious anthropology, in particular of Judaism, important there, where Judaism was great, revolutionary, know that there is more to man than his instinctive behavior betrays. There is more to man than his actions tell us. There is nothing more to the stone than his behavior. There is more to man than his behavior. There is more to man than his works. Man is greater than his works. While the stone is not greater than its activity. This strange being possesses not only surface, but also depth existence. Inwardness. Or I would say within-centeredness, in within-centeredness. Or self-containment, self-concentration, which does never express itself through automatic compulsive activity that is limited to the outside. There is always more to personality than its active participation in the order of things, or its active contribution to society. There is more to personality. The causal relational order encompasses man, yes, as well as other existences, animal, plant, and mineral. Yet while the latter, the latter is confined to this series, and everything in them is poured into their functioning, man transcends this realm of mechanical existence, the realm of functionality. He is not only a member of a comprehensive dynamic system like the animal, but he also finds his reality in immanence, in selfhood, in being rooted within, in personal collects and recesses. In an existence which cannot be exhausted in action, nor in behavior, nor in surface manifestation. There is always, you cannot say, man equals his activity. Man equals his behavior. It's a false equation. Never mind about any metaphysics. It's a false equation. Man is always greater than his works. Of course, if he is a really a creative being. It's interesting, the saying, the Midrashic saying, that Moses wrote the Torah, so some ink remained in the pen. So he wiped the pen on his forehead, and that's why his face began to be, because Moshe's face beam. What does it mean? Moshe could not express himself, everything. There is more to Moses than his work. And for instances, you know, the playwright, the famous Scandinavian playwright, Danish playwright, Ibsen, and there is the famous drama, Architect Solness, Architect Solness. In America, Ibsen was never apparently in the vogue, but in Europe, I mean, Western Europe, there are times when it seemed to be completely dominated by Ibsen. And without the rising tide of existentialism in America, Ibsen should come back, should be frequent into life, I mean, probably with the will. So there is Architect Solness. Ibsen describes an architect. Ibsen's people in general are very weak people. Weak. Not great characters. I mean, particularly the men. The women are much stronger, more possessive, domineering. I don't know, private duties. Childhood experiences, mother and father, I don't know exactly. Anyway, so in Architect Solness, Ibsen describes a great actor, the genius, who used to build all the churches, particularly the Gothic architecture. The architecture, the Gothic architecture, expresses men's desire for infinity, men's surging upward. I mean, this demonic gesture to encompass the universe, but to get into heaven. This is basically the Gothic architecture. So, but I mean, actually, Spengler rather than talk it this way. So he was a genius in designing such churches with the spiral towers and so forth. But he never dared to climb the tower he built. When he began to climb the tower he built, any tower he built, the beautiful tower, he used to get dizzy. So finally, some woman persuaded him. She was filmed, architect, someone's film architect.
Yes.
There was no fabula to it. There was no fabula. I can understand how Ibsen can lend itself to Hollywood. I don't know. Anyway, perhaps. So finally, one woman, a strong woman, convinces him to climb the church he built. And he climbs up to the bell tower, gets dizzy, falls down, and dies. What did Ibsen want to express? That the works of men are greater than him. Because he could design beautiful towers, he could never scale the heights. Which his works, actually, I think. And this is what Judaism says it's false. If one is an architect, so he's greater than his designs. This is exactly what Judaism would violently say. The creator is always greater than his creation. And again, because man was created in the image of God. And what is greater? God than his creation, than the universe. Of course, God is greater. And man is created in the image of God. So man is greater than his. If this architect, particular architect, can build such towers, shooting forward into heavens, he can scale them. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been. There's more to it. It's exactly what the Midrash says about Moses. He was greater than his pen. His pen is outside existence. But yes. Of course, this unique existence cannot be just observed. This unique existence, the within existence, not the surface existence, but the depth existence cannot be just observed in a manner reminiscent of Galileo's watching an object fall from the tower in Pisa. Because for simple reason, because there is something which is not subject to observation. Of course, we may through such observation attain important data concerning the outside existence of man, but no glimpse into the depth of the personality will be afforded. The latter cannot be exposed and cannot be actually expressed. Only how can I actually, if I want to know you are not you, of course, I can first observe you and me, and then I can make my deduction, an observation. I can observe the way your movements, your speech, I mean, the handwriting and so forth. And I can make certain deductions. Reduction will be just, I mean, the surface existence. Then I equate, your existence with your activity, like this stuff. But I want to get a little bit deeper into you. So what can you do? You know that, social workers, you certainly, it's an interview business. What does an interview mean? I don't observe. I may observe during the interview, but this is not the main purpose of the interview. Interview means revelation. I have to ask the person to reveal himself to me. Otherwise, what is analysis? Revelation. There is something new which I cannot observe. But he has to reveal. It's an act already of communication, willing, free communication. And I am always at liberty either to withhold communication or to pass on information. And here is where a man is a liar. It's hard to trust him. The stone doesn't have to communicate. I rest the information from the stone because the activity is subject to observation. I cannot grab it from a person because a person has within centeredness. The within centeredness cannot be just, I cannot observe. He has to communicate. It's an act only through active communication, through a willful bursting forth of the inmost, even hidden world of a person. It is possible to gain insight into a unique, one-timely, selfhood existence, which is focused not on the outside, but in itself. In short, the depth of the existence cannot be captured by an observer. An act of confession is necessary. Basically, this is confession. Any interview is a confession. Is a confession. When this mysterious personality steps freely closer to the surface and tries to reveal itself to the doll, when the eye turns from inner repose, toward the outside, then something intimate breaks through the crust of the surface and makes itself known to the other person. The parallelism is between divine revelation and human revelation. What does Judaism say? How do we know God? God revealed himself. If God hadn't willed to reveal himself, we wouldn't have known him. A person cannot know a person unless he reveals himself. The stone doesn't have to reveal himself. And of course, however, this process of communication is never an adequate one, gentlemen. The personal existence is unique, intimate, and strange. And it's very peculiarly felt and experienced by the eye. The thou can never share the intimate experience of the eye. It is insolubly bound up with the self. Only the eye knows himself as a self. And the knowledge, basically, is incommunicable to others. This is basically what Judaism stressed. Even when the eye is, so to say, frank, and truthful, and wants to confess to you, and wants to confide in you, to confide in others, and tries to reveal to the Tao the inward existence, his self, even when he makes an honest effort to bear his soul, he can never transcend the threshold of loneliness, of aloneness. To transfer experiences to and interweave them into the existential texture of others. Only those, even a moment of frank confession and confidential communication, is easy employs. How does a person confess? If I could tear my heart, as we say in the vernacular, and let other people take a look at my heart, perhaps they could find me. But how do I confess? How do I pour my heart? Through what? Through what medium? Language. What is language? Language is not an individual medium. Language is a universal symbol. The language is nothing unique about language, you see. After all, I employ the behavioral language of the surface, the signs and metaphors, an outside existence in which an outside existence expresses itself, in activities, in manifestations, in words. And it's impossible for words to express whatever is within me, because word is a standardized medium already. It's not a unique medium. The latter, the eye, is mute and remains a personal mystery, a perennial mystery to the outside world. Communication and self-revelation is to be considered as a noble attempt at self-transcendence. The man wants to transcend himself and reveal himself to us. A full communication is unattainable. The fullness of one's being, of one's personality, of his existential experience will never be perceived by others. All a person can communicate to them are symbols and signs which do not reflect this loneliness of man, means his uniqueness. And actually, the man remains in seclusion as an individual, singular being. Only those, you see, take for instance, psychoanalysts. Psychoanalysts also spoke about the subconscious and unconscious. But basically, the psychoanalyst, everything is expressive. The polite man represses certain experiences, but he can bring them to the surface by certain method. We say there is something in man which is inexpressible, not subconscious. The man is conscious. You know, that's what we say. The man is conscious, not subconscious. Perhaps he's subconscious too, but we don't care. Judaism did not deal with this problem. He's conscious of it. But it's his exclusive possession. He cannot make this treasure available to us. He cannot express itself. Let's not fool ourselves. I mean, in our daily intercourse with people, I mean, we find it. It is solitude. There are aspects of the personality which cannot be translated in universal experiences, standardized feelings, and awareness they have. It cannot be passed on by the individual to his fellow man. And these are confined to the depth of personality. This is exactly what's important. So actually, now, let us see. This is loneliness. Loneliness means within existence. If a person would have only a surface existence, he would never be lonely. Because he could communicate this to others, he would have no need for communication. It would have been observed, and captured by others, by just looking at him. But since he has to communicate his inner experiences, he cannot communicate. So he's lonely. There is a within existence which does not fit him into community. Because a community can only consist of people who have something in common, which can communicate to each other what they have. But if each one of us has something which he cannot communicate, which cannot be perceived by others, it is an individual heart, of course, sounds strangely and uncommonly. Of course, and electrocardiogram will show you this sound anyhow. Yes, I'm just, of course, it's a metaphor. But this is already an objectified data. But how the heart, my rhythm of the heart, which only I feel, no one else, this I can't communicate. No electrocardiogram can. It is a communicating gesture. Man wants to join the other self. He wants to form friendship with him. He wants to be to merge with him. Because he remains in solitude. As the personality as such, the self remains a solitary and lonely thing. And of course, gentlemen, I don't have to tell you. You know when people become aware of that? That is in times of crisis. We know as rabbis, for instance, and you probably know that too, if a man should be afflicted by a very bad disease, fatal disease, and more or less he's conscious of the fact that his days on earth are numbered, so you'll notice little by little an act of disengagement on his part. From all his concerns, from all his interests, even with regard to the next of kin, in regard to his children, in whom simply before when he was healthy, he simply gloried and rejoiced, and whom he saw himself reflected. A gradual extinction of interests in others. And this does not come with the gradual, so to say, disintegration of his mental capabilities. No. I saw people, for instance, suffering cancer, who still were mentally very alert, intellectually brilliant. Brilliant, intellectually. And still, and I know an aunt of mine was brilliant. And she had an only daughter, and actually she sacrificed her life for her daughter. But when she began to feel that she's doomed, so she lost interest in her daughter. And I saw it there. As a rabbi, I see it quite often. Somehow, it's for a simple reason. When man is taken out of this environment completely, he retreats into himself. And then when he retreats into himself, so he becomes a solitary individual. There's no communication. And possibly, for instance, we cannot pass on our feelings. As a matter of fact, can we pass on our feelings to our children, how much we love them? Does a child know how much his father and mother love him? He certainly doesn't. Because it's not the real thing. Of course, we can judge our love for him by our actions. That we suffer accountability, we try to give him education, we do everything that we need to promote his career, to build his future, yes, but there is no experience. We cannot experience our love for him. This is an inner spirit of the question. Is husband and wife get together so closely? Yes, even the most ideal marriage. But husband is a solitary figure and wife is solitary. There is not complete coalescence. It's ridiculous to speak of complete coalescence. Let, for instance, the husband take sick or the wife take sick. It doesn't matter. And let the husband and the other mate find out that it's sickness is painful. Of course, the first reaction will be that of hysteria. Of course, hysteria. Hysteria, despair. Despair, crying, and losing interest in the whole world. As if she or he cannot exist without her or his partner. Yes, but this is just an illusion. It's just a surface experience. Little by little, the individual begins to get used to the idea that he'll have to reorganize his life, to reorientate himself. And it's like, and he begins to think, although stealthily, he doesn't want to admit it to himself, stealthily, he begins to think in terms of rearrangement. How, when the wife or the husband will die, what I wouldn't say is he or she thinks of marriage. I wouldn't say that. I mean, although I'm not so sure about it. I'm not even sure about that. I'm not inviting anybody. I'm not inviting anybody. I'm not sure about anything, but rearranging. And I'll tell you, I don't like to speak about my experiences of others. I'll tell you about my own experience. I told you I had a father to whom I was very devoted. He's to me something which is not father. Anyway, this is a different problem. But my father took sick. He took sick and he died very quickly. Only he was sick for a couple of weeks. And he died from certain problems, some malignant disease. I don't know what it was. So when the doctor told me, so, of course, my first reaction was the usual reaction. Complete of numbness, mental numbness. Complete mental paralysis, spiritual paralysis. Hysteria. I don't cry, but it was hysterical. But little by little, gradually, and not knowing that, unconsciously, I was unknowingly, I began to see me already without my father. And see my house as if one piece of furniture, a beautiful piece of furniture, itself a centerpiece, of course, taken out. And like a woman, a hostess is very capable, when she wants to send out a certain centerpiece, will begin to think beforehand how to rearrange the room. I began to rearrange my life without my father, while my father was alive. Let's not fool ourselves. What does it show? It shows only there is no complete coalescence of two individuals. There is no complete merger. There is no complete communication. Even at the highest level of love and friendship and sympathy and understanding. Why is it? Because as I said, outside existences merge. Within existences cannot merge. Man, father is lonely, man is lonely. And the moment, as long as life flows in its normal channels, so I don't think about my within existence. So I concentrate on the outside. On the outside, I feel that I'm one with my father. But the moment, life has played this trick, there was a twist in my life. So I began to retreat from my outside existence. And of course, from my communication, from my bonds. With this vow, and I began to think, am I actually bound up with my father? Is the bond insoluble? And in a mute way, I answer the problem, the question that in the negative, no, it isn't insoluble. You are you, thou art thou, the father is he. And between he and thou, there is a gulf unbridgeable, and the gulf is that of loneliness. Of unique That means this paralysis can be terminated. Your outside existence will be hurt. Yes? Your outside existence. Your surface existence will be hurt. Your inner existence will not be affected. And if there is a within existence, you know, the very core, then the outside existence will readapt itself to the within center place. And it's exactly what happened. I carry a heart of God, my father. And I saw husbands and wives who thought they wouldn't be able to exist for a single day. And they carry on. And let us now, gentlemen, if you'll just give me a few more minutes, if you want. You see, in the Bible, if you look in the Bible, the English Bible, now, how was man created? How was man created? Now, David, how was man created? Alone or in company? Chapter 1, verse 26. 27, yeah, Genesis, 27. Will you be so kind and give me this Bible? 27, chapter 1.
27, huh? It's 27? No, second. No, okay, got it. And God created man, it is verse 27 here. And God created man in his own image. The image of God, in the image of God, created him. Male and female created he them. Please listen carefully. He created man, the man was created as a female and a male. This is chapter 1. Now take chapter 2. No, it's again, he said, in chapter 2, yes, in verse 18. Chapter 2, verse 18. And the Lord God said, it is not good that a man should be alone. I will make him a help meet for him. Yes? And out of the ground, finally, and the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon man, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the place of his flesh instead thereof, and the rib which the Lord God has taken from man, he made a woman, and brought her unto the man. And the man said, this is now my bone of my bones, and flesh of my flesh, she shall be called a woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and shall be one flesh. Of course, Bible critics already ask the question. There is a contradiction between these two chapters. In the first chapter, there is a story that God created man alone, but male and female, correct? Male and female. In the second chapter, God said that it's not good for man to be alone, and created Eve out of the ribs of Adam. And you know what the Bible critics say, that we have two accounts, but usually Bible critics make a wrong mistake. Many times they have problems. They don't try to solve the problems at the philosophical level. They already have a ready-made answer, and still a cult answer. Two accounts, two songs, and it's very good to say. But basically what the Bible describes here, two definitions of men. Men alone and men in company. Adam was created twice. Adam alone was Adam in the company with Eve. You see, in the morning on that Friday, on that mysterious Friday, God created Adam, male and female, but there was no communication between male and female.
Male was alone, female. No communication. It's lonely man, because it was created in the image of God. In the second account, there is no mention of the image of God. Man was created in the image of God. Man was alone. Letevi yoter adam levado, I mean, it's not good for man to be alone. It means only for Adam alone. It's not good for each to be alone either. There was no communication. In the second chapter, is the story how man steps out, tries to step out of his loneliness, of his solitude, of his seclusion, and join the woman. The woman is the first gesture of communication, and join Eve. It's two stories of men. Both stories are correct. They are not mutually exclusive. Just a moment. They are not mutually exclusive. Basically, there are two types of men in Judaism. If I may use one expression,
There is one man which I would call by the Greek name charismatic. Charisma means the message. A man who passes on messages to others. A charismatic man. This is a man who can communicate himself. And there is another man who is both, I would say also, the theological expression of it, numinous man, mysterious man. Man who cannot communicate with others. Man who remains alone, for himself, in himself, self-contained. He's always in repose. He cannot search power. He's always engaged in a movement of recoil. All of it for himself. He cannot express. And these two men are in every one of us. In every one of us, there is a charismatic man, a man who shares his experiences, a man who wants to tell and to relate and to pass on messages and to rejoice with others and to have others share his sorrows and his joys and his glories and his defeats. I mean, as Maimonides says, for Aristotle, a man is a social being. But by saying man is a social being, it's not said everything about men. Man is also a lonely being. A man who doesn't want to share anything. Not he doesn't want to be kind. I cannot share. Can I share with you my understanding of Judaism? I can tell you. Yes, I tell you. But it's not a question of knowledge. It's the appreciation and feeling and experience. I experience more than I can simply express in words. Basically, I'm not so, my facility for words is very limited in general. I mean, I have trouble in writing out a sentence and expressing myself. I always have, I mean, these what you call it in Hebrew, Sevle Yitzira, I mean, the suffering of creation. Of creation, I mean, particularly formulating thoughts, and I'm never sure that I formulate them well. So I try to repeat, and the more I repeat, the less understandable I am. Of course, it goes, but this is charismatic Adam, who was created the same Friday in the afternoon. Lectori the Yosad Lavari, from a practical standpoint, men should look for association, for a social life, for communication, for sharing, for togetherness. Yes, yes, and God created the woman out of his ribs, but not out of his heart. If the woman had been created out of his heart, there would be a perfect marital union. But this can't be. The heart is individual. It's the outside existence, it's the rib. Nothing else. Nothing else. There's Siamese twins can have two hearts, two beating hearts. I mean, two personalities. But there is a bond, a physical bond. I would say it's more than a physical. It's a medical bond. But it is what I say, a charismatic bond. A bond by passing on messages. By the dialogue. Eve and Adam carry on a dialogue. They are both charismatic beings. And of course, I understand that Adam courted Eve. I mean, otherwise she wouldn't have married him. So probably told her that he loves her. This is, he tried to communicate his love to Eve. Yeah. But did he not? He didn't succeed. Like any boy cannot, if he's sincere in his love, cannot communicate exactly what he feels to the girl. It is just a dialogue existence, a charismatic existence. The outside surfaces, the surface existence merged, the inner existence, but luminous man who God created, man and female, Eve was also created at that time, symbolically. But man remained simply alone. And in a moment of crisis, this bond was created between Adam and Eve, a charismatic bond via the dialogue, via the communication, via the revelation. Here, somehow, he's eliminated. And man remains alone as he was on Friday morning. Numinous man, man for himself. And I remember it was a few years ago, my daughter gave birth a child, her first child. And usually, a woman is very proud. First child, because it's the real possession she possesses. This possessive instinct of women expresses itself in her relationship to the first child. So I walked in after the priest, the circumcision in her room, congratulated her. So she was holding the baby, Osha, pressing him against her bosom, saying, You are my own. And I told her, it's a mistake. He's not your own. Of course, you'll realize it 15, 16, 20 years from now. because men cannot be, cannot join the Tao completely. Because Adam was created twice at two levels, at the numinous level of longness and the charismatic level of togetherness. If one is foolhardy and is naive enough to think that everything is his, the friends are his, parents are his, children are his, everything is his, of course, he lives a life of Adam, the charismatic Adam, Friday afternoon, then Eve, when he met Eve, and he thought that he established a marital union, an inseparable union. But he forgot about the permanent crisis, about the permanent distress. He will wake up, he will find himself that he's not only charismatic Adam with the company of Eve, that Eve is God and he's at home. And this should be always remembered. Right up to here, we'll develop later.